Hello, welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Player Podcast. I'm Travis. Today, we're going to talk about the idea of what would happen to student loan borrowers if DOGE eliminated the Department of Education and all student loans as we know it. So we're going to dive deep. We're going to take a look at all of the proposals that are being thrown around out there. We're going to talk about what borrowers need to know, and we're going to calm your nerves in today's podcast. Let's talk about what would happen if President Trump and Musk and DOGE combined forces to completely eviscerate Department of Ed like they did USAID, like they did the CFPB. What are the chances of this? What would it mean for borrowers? First, you know, how much power President Trump may or may not have over education policy, right? So let's talk about this a little bit. If Trump is able to shut down all these other agencies, it's a natural thought to think that he could shut down something like Department of Ed too. There's a little bit of a difference in USAID and CFPB and the Department of Education, right? So CFPB is a relatively new agency, came out of the financial crisis, right, with Dodd-Frank. And the CFPB does still exist. There's an acting director of the CFPB. It's the Treasury Secretary. And the CFPB also existed in the first Trump administration. Essentially, you didn't hear a whole lot about the CFPB because the CFPB was staffed with folks that didn't really believe it should exist. In terms of regulating businesses, in terms of protecting consumers' regulations, like you didn't see a whole lot of rules compared to during the Biden administration where you saw the CFPB with a very activist director come out all the time with a lot of rules that was trying to protect consumers. If you think about the differences, you might say, well, naturally, Department of Ed could face the same result. Because Department of Ed is just another governmental group, so why can't they do all the same things to that? And I think there's some big differences. First of all, again, CFPB is still being fought over as to whether or not it should exist. There's still lawsuits debating as to whether or not it should be an independently created agency like the Federal Reserve kind of thing with its own funding or whatever, right? So I think that there's still battles over whether or not that program or that agency should exist at all. And with Department of Education, when it came out, they tried to shut it down. They didn't. Department of Ed has grown very large, is 4,000 employees, right? That's a ton of people. And so they're trying to starve Department of Ed as much as they can of things to do to shrink the size of the department and therefore its importance. If you're able to shift curriculums with any kind of like civil rights enforcement or anything like that, if you're able to shift that to other agencies, if it's statutory, for them, that's a win. If you are able to rein in anything at Department of Ed, that's a win. Now, I think that the thing that they're going to find when they audit Department of Ed is they're going to find an absolute mess because it is an absolute mess. You know, if you really think about income-driven repayment right now, because of how everything has been handled with the rollout of SAVE, with the pandemic, with the Biden administration, you know, continually kicking a can down the road and income-driven recertification, if they look at the programs like IDR, they're going to see a majority of people paying nothing. That's why I think the people need to be ready to recertify their incomes is because they're going to audit this stuff at some point a lot more heavily than they're currently doing. So if you have not been thinking about how you file your taxes for your 2024 tax return, you need to think about it because they could just say, hey, one of the easiest ways that we could get a lot of money coming in the door again is just force everybody back into repayment immediately. And you know, if they don't have the SAVE plan, they could put everybody into the IBR plan if they wanted to because that's in the statute. I looked through the statute. I actually read the statutes today. In the statutes, it says in the IDR part of the statute, it says the Secretary of Education shall about 35 times. And then I looked at the PSLF statutes, and that says Secretary of Education shall about 34 times. That's pretty explicit. That's very much you have to do this through the Department of Ed. And I think that's why we saw some Republican comments about, well, maybe we'll leave the big loan program behind in Department of Ed, but we're going to move all the K-12 stuff out. We're going to move all the gender-related things out. We're going to eliminate all the DEI office stuff, right? So all the civil rights enforcement stuff. So there's a lot of things in the statute that they can't get rid of. So that's one thing to be relatively able to be calm about. I'm going to start like kind of what I think that Trump and Musk could do at Department of Ed, because they can't shut it down, but they could do some pretty intense things. And I want to talk about what they cannot do. One thing they could easily do is tighten the definition of a PSLF qualifying employer. Now, a little bit of tightening would mean trying to roll back some of the new guidance from President Biden, right? It's trying to roll back. I mean, we just want to be clear. We haven't heard anything about this at all yet. So this is just pure speculation. But if they wanted to, obviously they could roll back the idea of allowing, for example, Kaiser Permanente physicians to qualify for PSLF if they wanted to, because that was something the Biden administration just randomly decided. Do I think they're going to do it? I don't think so. I hope not. I don't want to make anybody super worried about that because we can't control it, but they could, because PSLF qualifying employer, there's a little bit of wiggle room in there as to what that actually means. You know, when we're talking about PSLF, they could also roll back PSLF definitions to the original definition during the first Trump administration, which is you have to work full-time according to your employer's definition, not just the 30 hours a week. You know, there's a couple like memorandums of understanding that predated that new rule with Biden, with like the Minnesota Teachers Union, Minnesota Nurses Union, where it explicitly said, hey, all hospitals have to sign the forms if you're 30 hours a week or more. And that was pre-Biden. And then Biden came out and said, hey, it's 30 hours a week. So those are some things they could do with PSLF. A couple other things, they could do a hardcore audit of income-driven repayment. So if I think about the current IDR repayment system, right, there's a lot of people that have not been submitting all their full income documentation. There's a lot of, in my opinion, bad advice being given out there that you can just maximize your 401k and turn into pay stub with zero income and then get $0 payments for the whole year. In my opinion, that's fraud. You can't do that. And you know, yeah, like if somebody says that their family size is 93, your payment will be $0 a month and it's only going to be a problem until you get caught. There was a GAO investigation, I believe, in February 2020. I can't remember off the top of my head for sure, but it like happened, I think, right before the pandemic or right in the early stages of the pandemic, and it drowned out everything else. But it was a pretty damaging report that caused at least one guy to go to jail because that was the guy that was doing the telling the government that people had 93 children so he could get people's payments to zero. This is just an example of they could easily say, okay, how do we catch people who have not been reporting their income information? If you use your tax return, you're real safe because that's you can't argue with the tax return. Now, if you're submitting your IDR recertification, here's what I think we need to be really careful about. Okay, I want to make some things clear. In case there's any confusion out there, you have to include all sources of taxable income if you use alternative documentation of income. Now, I'm going to give you an example of where I think there's wiggle room. If you have an income that falls a lot, if your income goes down like suddenly, like you're taking parental leave, you quit your job, something like that, I think it's fine to contact them and update your income. I think it's fine to do that. I think it's fine to just say you don't have a taxable income because at that very moment you lost your taxable income. You haven't gotten the dividend check that month. So I think it's reasonable to say, okay, you lose your job or you take a break in income or you go way down in income, go ahead and recertify just with the statement that your income went down. I think that's fine. Where I'm concerned, though, is people that are doing like this year in and year out and not providing all the taxable income. That's where I'd be real concerned. So for example, if you have an S corporation, if you're a dental practice owner or something like that, you've got to report not just your W-2 wages, you've got to report your K-1 dividends too when you do alternative documentation of income. So you can do that with an employer letter showing your wages and showing your K-1 income from the prior year if your tax return doesn't show an accurate number. You can absolutely get in big trouble if the Trump administration or GAO or somebody like that audits IDR recertification and you're using an income number that is not accurate, that it's going to come back to bite you. Now, it's real interesting. I actually have seen this trip a lot of people up because I've noticed on the IDR recertification application online, it used to say include all sources of taxable income on that. The paper application still says that, but the Biden administration took all of that out and they basically said, and I'm not making this up, right? They said, you know, you can show a bank statement. You can say, like, they basically said you can just make something up for your IDR recertification and they don't care. I mean, that was kind of the goal, is to make sure that nobody paid almost anything, thinking that frankly, you know, it would help them win an election. That was kind of the thought, is we don't want anybody recertifying their income before an election because that'll cost us politically. Obviously, that didn't work out. They didn't, obviously, in Biden's case, didn't run, and the administration didn't win the election. And then now we've got an administration that is trying to do a bunch of expensive, unpaid for things, like big tax cuts for people with higher incomes, disproportionately benefiting, and it's very deficit financed, and they are hunting for savings. if they do the Doge analysis or something and they find, oh, wow, you know, out of the people that are in repayment, people, there's a $1 trillion of student loans in repayment, and we're only collecting, you know, $5 billion a month, let's say, hypothetically, we could be collecting twice that if we forced people to recertify their incomes. I think they're probably going to do that. So be ready for that. A couple other things that could happen, depending on how hardball they were going to go, they could potentially look at restricting federal student loans by, you know, Democratic administrations typically make gainful employment rules, which say you have to get at least 10% of your funding. I think this is what the rule says, like at least 10% of your funding externally, not from federal student loans purposes. And you also need to get decent student outcomes for employment and those sorts of things, right? So like the Trump administration could make its own rule and target nonprofit colleges. They could say, hey, if you're a nonprofit college, you produce students with debt to earn income greater than 3-to-1, like you're cut off from the program. And there might be lawsuits and such, but they could try to do that in the same way that Democrats have historically gone after for-profit colleges with low-quality programs. The Trump administration could go after not-for-profit colleges, and maybe the programs are high quality, but maybe they're just really expensive. And then maybe they could try to make an argument, well, those programs shouldn't really qualify to receive student loans. Be interesting to think about what could happen there. A few more things that they could do. We could see a hiring freeze at Department of Ed, maybe even reducing support and processing for, you know, people that process the applications. I mean, there's a massive backlog right now. We've got Mohila sending out all these random letters saying, you know, that people are in a, you know, if you're not processed within 60 days, they're putting you into some sort of 0% holding pattern forbearance. I mean, that's going to be something else, I think, that's going to go away. These 0% interest freezes during forbearances or something like that. I mean, that's something that's probably not going to last very long either. So those are some of the things. So I guess the other thing is they could try to make, you know, a new version of a repayment plan, right? They could try to say, we're going to make a new repayment plan through the ICR statute that's way worse than repay and save. And that's if they don't eliminate the save plan outright and the courts don't strike down the ICR statute usage. Those are all those sorts of things. And, you know, you might say, oh my gosh, that's a terrible list. Well, what's not at risk, right? PSLF, IBR, that's not at risk. It's in the statute. And you might say, well, they don't have to follow the statute. Well, yeah, they do eventually. I mean, a lot of the stuff that they've been doing with CFPB and USAID and all these agencies is they're essentially trying to get as many people out of those agencies as oppose them as they can through the buyouts, right? And they're also trying to do funding freezes and spending reviews. And they're trying to do things as much as they can to make it difficult for folks that don't support their agenda to operate in those departments. And the funding freezes cannot last forever. If Congress appropriates the money, you have to use it at some point. You do. Remember that there was a freeze on all federal loans and grants. I remember because my wife was working on an NIH grant and she wasn't able to get anything from that or even get communication from that. And then boom, a court came in and issued an injunction and stopped the Trump administration, and they rescinded the order and they moved on to the next thing. You know, just to be clear, administrations, especially new administrations of different political parties, like they do this and they both do it differently. So if Trump is going after federal loans and grants, like remember that Biden was, you know, issuing a eviction moratorium nationwide and saying it was due to the pandemic when he kind of said, okay, we're going to end it because the Supreme Court's striking it down. And then he got pressure from progressive groups and his party to extend the eviction moratorium, and he did it, and even said, I'm doing this to buy people more time, but I know the courts are going to strike it down anyway. In other words, like he issued an order that explicitly he knew was not going to be legal, and he did it because it would buy people an extra month or two without being evicted. So President Trump is doing something that's, you know, kind of opposite politically. He's going after federal loans and grants that, you know, help fund things that a lot of people benefit from. And but he views that as wasteful spending. And so their administration is trying to rein in stuff as much as they can. And I don't think that it's helpful to probably worry about things that we can't control. What we can control is, okay, what's the definition of PSLF? What's the definition of IBR? You know, do you have a debt to income ratio above 2-to-1? If you do, IBR is still your best bet, most likely, right? It's still probably the best option to go for forgiveness in 20 and 25 years if you have more than a 2-to-1 debt to income ratio, even if you're in the private sector. And if you're in the public sector, of course, PSLF is still on the table. And if you owe less debt than what you earn every year, you make, you know, $200,000 a year, you got $100,000 in debt. Unless there's some super special reason why you're keeping your loans federal, you need to just probably refinance and pay it off. Because the only exception to that rule would be if you're getting a 0% interest subsidy because you're still hanging out on the save forbearance. If that's the case, go stuff your money in cash, a savings account, get 4% interest, and just wait until the 0% interest ends and then see what options are available out there for refinancing. Because there are actually historically low credit spreads right now. It's kind of amazingly low in a lot of cases. But that's not the reason to refinance, right? You refinance and you're ready to burn the bridge behind you and you're ready to cross the Rubicon and know there's no way out but paying off the debt in full. It's kind of a psychological advantage, but you do need to actually get a interest rate edge to do that. So we obviously have cash bonuses on the site, studentloanplanner.com/refi, if you do decide you need to pay back your loans. But a lot of people in the middle that have that 1-to-2 debt to income ratio, it's a little bit uncertain. And let me say this, there's a lot of benefit in buying yourself time and just continuing to grow your net worth. So if you're uncertain if you should go for forgiveness or not, you can buy yourself time by continuing to pay the minimum that you owe, build up your savings and investments in other areas, and then put off the decision. 4 years seems like it's going to be a long time, but in the grand scheme of life, life is short. 4 years will pass and you'll be like, where'd the time go? And then you might have a Democratic administration. Who knows if that administration is more centrist or more progressive than the Biden administration? And if they go big on student loans again, well, suddenly you might feel, oh, shoot, if I have my 1.5 debt to income ratio, I wish I would have kept it federal. Now, I do think that things go in pendulums. I think that people would feel like they would want to kick themselves with the interest pause if they had refinanced. But keep in mind, when people refinanced in 2021 and 2022, a lot of people were locking in 3% interest rates with 20-year terms. Yes, the 0%, losing that 0%, 2 years of extra extension, it was painful. But I can promise you, people I talk to now that got a 2 or 3% interest rate when they refinanced in 2021, 2022, or even 2023, they're pretty happy overall. Like, I don't hear from that many people that are upset besides the ones that could have got PSLF that refinanced. Those people I do hear from that are bummed that they did that. But generally speaking, you know, I don't get a lot of people that are real upset that they refinanced at that 2 or 3% interest rate level unless that there's PSLF involved. What is going to happen next? We're going to have a lot of scary headlines. There's going to be a lot of stuff in the media scaring people. There will be some things that actually do impact borrowers negatively. It could be tightening of PSLF. It could be forced recertification of income. It could be the announcement that the SAVE plan is toast or a legal, you know, ruling that says the SAVE plan is toast. And it could mean people suddenly have to pay big amounts of money again. So I am concerned that, you know, a lot of borrowers are going to feel IDR payments start again, and they're really not going to have felt those for like 5-6 years because people have not had to recertify for so long. And when those payments start, some of those payments are going to be enormous. I mean, if you think about an attending physician who's got a $300K income, that person might have to pay $2,500 a month, and they're used to paying $200 or $300 a month from an ultra extended IDR recertification getting pushed out every few months over and over again. So at some point that's going to end. And is your budget ready? Hopefully it is. And remember though, that this is just an income tax. It's still an income tax. If it's better to pay it as a percentage of your debt, you can do that, but only if it's a better deal. You don't have to do that if it's not a better deal. And keep in mind too, we're going to also see probably in spring the discussions about a big bill on the Trump tax cuts that's going to include a lot of stuff, and there's going to be a ton of lobbying and a lot of news coverage about it. And I would anticipate that they will try to get something passed or at least get the major bill worked up by like the late spring, early summer. And then you might see them try to get it done, you know, sometime before. I think if I recall correctly, they were able to get the first Trump tax cuts passed in the fall, but I could be off on that timing. So that's what we're going to be following is executive orders and actions with Trump. We could see a lot of stuff. We could see a lot of things that tighten things up on the loan forgiveness front. And then you have to look at the legislative stuff with the big bill, the reconciliation bill that might try to rein in IDR programs for the future. Now, if that happens, that would be huge. It would be shocking. because they had unified GOP control in 2017, 2018, and they were not able to pass major student loan legislation at all. And the margin in the House, I believe, was a little bit larger than it is now. Can we expect that they're actually going to do something? I think that probability-wise, it's more likely than not that they won't. And we'll just see a lot of Trump-type executive orders and student loans that are going to be restrictive of loan forgiveness and forcing people to recertify their incomes and things like that. But we'll see. I'll go ahead and end it for today. If you go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, would love to get your questions. I love featuring listener questions. That's always a fun thing to do in every pod episode. If you have any fears about things you're worried that could be taken away from you, feel free to go to that URL and share your concerns or your fears or your questions. And we just really appreciate you listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Remember that every Friday, we're doing more of a wealth building themed episode to give you just a little bit of different content, some stuff that's really uplifting. It's targeted towards people that are current and former six-figure student loan borrowers on those Friday shows. Also, I would encourage you, if you are a dentist, physician, or veterinarian, we have profession-specific shows for you. So I would type in financially free physicians or financially free dentists, if you're one of those professions. And then the veterinary financial podcast, it's a slightly different name for the veterinarians. But if you type in those names on whatever podcast platform you listen to, you'll be able to subscribe to one of those shows if it fits your profession. And basically, you're going to get a profession-specific version of the Student Loan Planner podcast, which I think you're going to really enjoy. And in a perfect world, you do so much laundry and go to the gym so often, you're listening to all of them. But of course, we appreciate deeply any shows of ours that you choose to listen to, and we don't take your listenership for granted. So thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you want to leave a question for the show. And remember, financially free physicians, financially free dentists, and veterinary financial podcast, if your occupation fits one of those three, follow those shows from our team over at SLP Wealth. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of your week.